This is The Political Scene, a weekly conversation with New Yorker writers and guests about politics. It's Thursday, February 18th. I'm Dorothy Wickenden, executive editor of The New Yorker. In the wake of the January 6th insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, several social media companies banned a host of far-right figures, as well as President Trump. The move provoked accusations from the right that Twitter, Facebook, and other platforms had violated their users' constitutional right to free speech. When Simon & Schuster canceled plans to publish a book by Senator Josh Hawley, whose rhetoric was seen as supportive of the insurrectionists at the Capitol, Hawley tweeted that it was, quote, a direct assault on the First Amendment. And when Trump stood trial in the Senate for inciting the insurrection, his lead attorney, Michael Van der Veen, repeatedly invoked his client's First Amendment rights.
There is no doubt Mr. Trump engaged in constitutionally protected political speech that the House has improperly characterized as incitement of insurrection. The fatal flaw of the House's argument is that it seeks to mete out governmental punishment, impeachment, based on First Amendment political speech. Speech for political purposes is the kind of activity to which the First Amendment offers its strongest protection. These are bedrock principles recognized by our Supreme Court for decades.
The country's ever-present disagreements over what exactly constitutes free speech have taken on new urgency in this era of little regulated social media, disinformation, calls to violence, and so-called cancel culture. Andrew Morantz, a New Yorker staff writer, joins me to discuss the future of free speech in our splintered country. Andrew, welcome back.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
It's always good to have you make sense of the right and the social media companies that have extended the reach of these groups and their ability to organize. So let's begin by having you tell us about how you're thinking about the last 6 weeks or so, the mobs at the Capitol, the banning of Trump on Twitter and Facebook, and the impeachment trial in the Senate.
Yeah, there's a lot to think about. And I don't want to sort of glibly say, you know, that there are no concerns here that are worth taking seriously. I do ultimately come down on the side that, let's say, Trump being banned from Twitter or Josh Hawley's book contract getting canceled, these are not actually First Amendment issues, for the simple reason that the First Amendment says Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. It doesn't say Twitter shall make no rule or Simon & Schuster shall make no morality clause, right? So it's not literally a First Amendment issue. But as I say, I think it would be far too glib to think that there are no concerns here. I think there are real concerns about consolidation of corporate power. I think it's pretty worrisome that a few tech billionaires in Silicon Valley have such a massive amount of control over the public square. I think it's not great that book publishing is consolidated and is consolidating still further. So I don't think it's literally true that these people are being silenced or, you know, these are among the most powerful and platformed and famous people in the world, right? So I was listening to Fox News yesterday as Donald Trump, you know, called in and was given many, many minutes of airtime, right? So these people are not being disappeared in some kind of Orwellian sense. And the cudgel of, you know, you're censoring me, you're abridging my free speech rights is used way, way, way too freely by all kinds of people, and these days especially by the right. But that doesn't mean that we can't be concerned about slippery slopes. I think the issue is, though, holding our concerns in tension with one another. We can't be so concerned with untrammeled free speech that we have no other competing concerns.
And it's been so clear ever since the 2016 election that these platforms have just allowed lies and disinformation to proliferate in the name of free speech. Some of the bans that these companies have, in my view, somewhat belatedly made against Trump are permanent. That includes, I believe, Twitter and Snapchat. Some are temporary, most notably Facebook. What do you think the lasting effects are going to be of the storming of the Capitol on these companies?
Yeah, look, there is a fair amount of arbitrariness here, right? You had Donald Trump literally using Twitter to threaten nuclear war. He didn't get banned for that, but he did get banned for a tweet that said, "I will not be attending the inauguration," which was not only among the tamer things he's ever said on Twitter, but it was also actually a newsworthy thing. I actually read that as the closest we were ever going to get to a concession from him. And yet Twitter banned him for that and one other also, in my view, pretty innocuous tweet. So I think it just points to how confused and expedient and often hypocritical these companies have been. They've never been held to account for this stuff. They were given a free pass by everyone, by investors, by the media, by society at large for about a decade, where they would just say, you know, we're revolutionizing communication. We want to make the world a better place. And no one ever really stopped them in any kind of rigorous way and said, well, what are you going to do about all the dangerous, noxious, bigoted, potentially violent stuff on your platforms? It's just whenever you hear tech companies joining in this chorus of free speech above all, laissez-faire is the only way to handle these problems, I think it's worth keeping in mind that this is the most convenient position for them. It's the position that allows them to do the least in terms of moderation. It's also the position that allows them to feel internally consistent, because the only really blanket consistent answer is we're not going to do anything. The problem, though, is that even though there is a slippery slope when you start cutting off people's speech, and even though we should take that slippery slope seriously, I think you also have to take seriously the other slippery slope, which is what happens if you do nothing and you allow thugs and authoritarians and, you know, would-be tyrants to start taking over governments and inciting violence. I truly don't see how you can worry about one slippery slope while disregarding the other.
Absolutely. And obviously, the thing that these companies fear the most is some kind of government regulation. And we had a piece in The New Yorker last week online by Kate Klonick, who reported about Facebook's new oversight board, which adjudicates appeals about what kinds of speech should be allowed on the site. And apparently, its decisions will be binding and override even those of Mark Zuckerberg. And it sounds like they could make an announcement as early as this week about whether Trump can return to the platform. So what do you think about all of that and about the effects that this board will actually have?
Yeah, it's very interesting and complicated. And actually, Kate and I have had many discussions about it. And I think there are places where we agree and places where we disagree. It may be true that their decisions are binding, but there are certain decisions that the board won't even be arrogating to itself the power to make. In other words, they're going to make pretty narrowly defined decisions about whether something that has been taken down on Facebook should be put back up. But it seems clear from the way their mandate is written that they're not going to make decisions about the basic core business model and core financial interests of Facebook itself. So the Supreme Court of the United States can come back to the government in certain rare instances and say, this law that you just wrote is unconstitutional and you need to throw it out. It doesn't seem to be the case that the Oversight Board is going to do that when it comes to the really core business model of Facebook. In other words, you're not going to see a decision from them that says, your algorithms are inciting emotional engagement and addiction and depression and data mining in ways that are incompatible with freedom and democracy, and you should shut your company down, right? Now, Of course, it's a very important step, and I think it's a canny step on Facebook's part, and I think it's definitely worthy of consideration and coverage, and I think everyone should read that piece. But I think it's worth wrestling with, and I think the piece does wrestle with how there are many, many ways to hold these companies to account, and this is hardly the end of the accountability.
And what about some of the other companies? So Twitter has permanently banned Trump's account, even if he runs for office again. Is there any indication that they will do this for, you know, on a wider basis for other politicians and others who are inciting dangerous actions?
I mean, I think part of the problem is that there's very little consistency, and these companies are always trying to create as little precedent as possible. You mentioned that the thing they fear above all is regulation, and I think that's true, but I think there's also another core fear they have, which is that half of the country would decide that these companies are biased against them and would leave in droves or would boycott the company. I think that's whether it's a well-founded fear or not, I think Twitter and Facebook and all the rest of them live in constant terror that every, you know, Fox News viewing Trump loving American will suddenly boycott their products. Now, I don't think that would be justified, because I think that Facebook in particular is really has been very, very kind to right-wing causes and has bent over backwards to, in many cases, allow them to bend or break rules, and has allowed fake news to proliferate way more from the right than it does from the left. But the reason these companies are doing that is to placate a big part of their base audience. So that is part of why they're so careful to avoid setting clear precedents here. For a long time, they wanted to say that there was this broad newsworthiness exemption. You know, any public figure whose utterances were inherently newsworthy would have broad latitude to speak. They've started slightly walking that back, but it's been very case by case. And so you have a situation where Trump is banned, but Marjorie Taylor Greene is not. And, you know, just to use the Marjorie Taylor Greene example, even as she is one of the most famous freshman members of Congress arguably ever, and even as she has active social media accounts and all the rest of it, she still takes to the floor of Congress wearing a mask that says censored. So to exactly the point we're talking about, people can say they're being censored and they can say that their free speech is being threatened regardless of what the facts actually are. Marjorie Taylor Greene has more free speech than almost anyone else in the world, and yet she can go out and claim that she's a free speech martyr, and, you know, it seems like about half the country will believe it.
Hi, it's David Remnick. If you're enjoying this podcast, you might enjoy even more of what The New Yorker has to offer. Becoming a subscriber gives you unlimited access to The New Yorker, including Pulitzer Prize-winning reporting, insightful cultural commentary, and fiction and poetry. You'll also enjoy our delightful cartoons, crossword puzzles, narrated stories, and much more. This past year, our readers were gripped by Ronan Farrow's profile of Elon Musk, Heidi Blake's extraordinary tale about Dubai's runaway princesses, and much more. Visit NewYorker.com to gain access to all this and more. Use the code POD15, P-O-D-1-5, to secure a 15% discount on a yearly digital subscription. That's POD15 for a 15% discount.
Talk a little bit about Parler, the social media platform, one of them that really caters to the far right, which has been resurrected after being forced offline in January by Apple, Google, and Amazon. I'm forgetting the name of the company that has agreed to take them on. Maybe just tell us a little bit about what's going on there.
Yeah, that one I actually do worry about even more from a kind of, again, not a specifically a First Amendment perspective, but from a kind of First Amendment analogous perspective. So it does worry me as someone who does cherish and value the concept of freedom of expression that some of the biggest companies in the world can decide all at the same time to make a website disappear from the face of the earth. Now, I think there's a lot of stuff on Parler that is obviously dangerous and was obviously being used to coordinate real violent activities that did get people killed and aimed to get more people killed. And that's obviously something that should be taken seriously. But again, it does worry me how much of this power is consolidated in the hands of people like Jeff Bezos. And, you know, there's this concept of the technology stack, that there's a sort of stack of a layering of infrastructure that the sort of near the top of the stack is someone who has a Twitter account and who refuses to follow the rules. That's sort of up to their individual discretion. When you get lower and lower on the stack, when you start regulating the pipes through which the information flows, metaphorically speaking, that starts to worry me a little bit more. So when you have places like Amazon Web Services, you know, choking off Parler's access to being online, you know, again, I'm not sticking up for the speech that was taking place on Parler where people were saying, you know, I'm going to drive to D.C. with a bunch of guns and bombs. But I do think that we shouldn't be too flippant about what happens when websites start disappearing.
So followers of QAnon believed when they attacked the Capitol that they were part of a storm, as they put it, that would result in the mass arrest of Trump's enemies and restore Trump to power. They were really shocked when Biden was sworn into office.
Yeah. So with stuff like QAnon, I think it should be obvious, if it's not already obvious, that we're in a kind of post-logical place when it comes to this stuff. You're talking about a set of axioms, a set of, you know, beliefs and practices that are, you know, social and faith-based, and that doesn't admit of sort of fact-checking and rebuttal in the same way. And I think what the record shows us is that when facts on the ground contradict a community's faith-based first principles, they don't just suddenly wake up the next morning and say, oh, never mind, we were wrong. You know, this has a lot more to do with identity construction and community building than it has to do with, you know, Snopes.com.
You mentioned the other day to me that one of your favorite books was When Prophecy Fails. Maybe you could talk a little bit about that because it's totally apropos here.
Yeah, I think about this one all the time. You know, this is where we get the concept of cognitive dissonance. The theory of cognitive dissonance comes from Leon Festinger and the other psychologists who wrote this book, When Prophecy Fails. And what they did was actually an act of undercover ethnography, or really undercover reporting. They went and embedded with a group of UFO cultists in 1954 who had become convinced that they were all going to be taken up into the sky in a kind of Christian rapture, but from spacemen, from people coming in on flying saucers. And they announced the date on which this would happen. It was going to be December 21st, 1954. Spoiler, the spacemen don't show up. And then they are sitting in the living room with these, you know, 10 or so cult members and watching what they do next. And essentially, one guy goes and gets his coat and hat and walks out the door. And the other 10 or so people stay, and they start poring over the messages they've received from the aliens to try to figure out, okay, what did we get wrong? What did we misinterpret? In other words, a majority of the people do not suddenly, you know, snap out of it and say, oh, the prophecy has failed. It's time for us to resume our normal lives. They dig in their heels further. And what you actually see is that they start proselytizing, because the theory goes that when you've invested enough publicly in a certain belief system, you've essentially gone too far to back down. And so in order to reconcile that cognitive dissonance, the theory goes, you start trying to draw more people in. I think you're seeing it now with QAnon. Some people leave, but the people who stay become even more invested in drawing more people into their circle, because that's the only way they can see to resolve the tension.
I want to talk a little bit about cancel culture. It's something Republicans love to attack. And I thought you could just tell us a little bit more first about how this phrase has taken on a life of its own within the GOP's circles.
Yeah, it's become a kind of free-floating signifier that's kind of like, you know, Marjorie Taylor Greene using the term free speech or censorship. I mean, what it's actually supposed to mean is, you know, somebody tweets something and then the world pounces and descends on them and they get canceled, you know, for some kind of frivolous thing. And yeah, that does happen. But I would say most of the time you see this wielded, especially in political contexts, it's somebody saying something worthy of criticism and people criticize them. And, you know, we're talking shortly after the death of Rush Limbaugh, who I think has done more than any single person I can think of to reframe all criticism of bigotry and racism and misogyny as political correctness, right? A huge amount of our vocabulary around this stuff comes from Rush and people following in his tradition. So, you know, if he calls you a feminazi and you strike back at him and say, I don't like that, I think you're a misogynist, you know, you're being a snowflake, you're being politically correct, you know, you just can't handle the majestic wit of his joke, right? And this is the kind of a move that the right wing just continues to revel in doing. And it's taken many forms and it's, you know, metastasized in various ways, but it's essentially the same move over and over again.
So we touched earlier on the difficulties of regulating speech, and it's not a subject that the left particularly loves approaching either, even though Mark Zuckerberg, the CEO of Facebook, has been called to testify before Congress twice. But there just isn't any agreement about how exactly to regulate social media. So at this critical juncture, what kind of free speech culture should we be striving for? And how can we create room for free speech without giving free rein to forces that could undermine other civil liberties.
Right. I think we should be striving for as free a free speech culture as possible. The question is, how do we define what's possible? So I think that you have to hold in tension the value of free speech, which is and should be enormous and which should be protected. You have to hold that in tension with, you know, do we want to have a democracy where we can have elections that are not overturned by mobs? Do we want to have the right for people in majority African-American neighborhoods to vote? Do we want to have people be free of fear that they're going to lose their lives if they tweet the wrong thing, right? So I think we would be really making a mistake if we allow, you know, the debate over are you for or against free speech to become polarized in the same way that every other issue in our culture gets polarized. I truly don't think this is a left versus right thing. Nor do I think that you can just sort of hand wave away the real costs here. You know, I think it's actually instructive to think about an analogy to climate change. Are there dangers to small businesses when they are asked to comply with too much regulation? Maybe, you know, you could find instances where that happens. Should we be so afraid of red tape and regulation that we don't allow the government and the private sector to stop destroying the world through climate change? No, we should not. And I think a similar thing is happening in our information ecosystem. What I can't abide is this notion that you hear from the tech companies themselves, from bad faith actors, you know, in the media, and, you know, just from a lot of sort of bad faith people in broader society who say, you know, free speech means that you can't ever do anything. You can't ever curtail anyone's right to say anything. You can't push back against it. You can't be dismayed about it. You can't say anything about it, or you're a tyrant and you're George Orwell and you're, you know, censoring me. It's far too late for that. That doesn't hold water anymore.
Thanks so much, Andrew.
Thank you.
Andrew Morant is a New Yorker staff writer and the author of Antisocial: Online Extremists, Techno-Utopians, and the Hijacking of the American Conversation. This has been The Political Scene. You can subscribe to this and other New Yorker podcasts by searching for The New Yorker in your podcast app and find more political analysis and commentary on newyorker.com. Feel free to rate and review us on Apple Podcasts. Our theme music is by Russell Gillespie. This program was produced by Alex Barron and Kylie Warner for newyorker.com. I'm Dorothy Wickenden.